meetings are recorded. Do we have any community input tonight?
The summit, I'm sorry.
Miss Dunn.
The summit is happy.
Can you come all the way forward? Because. Washington State Community Summit is being held in Wenatchee on June 16th, 17th, and 18th. It's a phenomenal conference. I hear there might be some scholarships available, and all families should attend and take your young adults with you. And it's a great place to learn all kinds of new cutting edge best practice information. When did you say that was, Darla? June
16, 17, 18. In Wenatchee.
In Wenatchee.
Any other community input tonight? Okay. So then we will get on to DDA eligibility.
Okay. So thank you for having us. My name is Beth Crable, and I'm the program manager for eligibility in the social service payment systems with DDA. And I have with me Barbara Umberger. She's the Region 3 eligibility coordinator. I'm going to get started with a brief recap of why we changed our eligibility rules in 2014. So that may not be new information to you. And after that, Barbara will talk to you about eligibility. So there was a major revision of eligibility rules in 2005, sparked by a 2002 report from the Joint Legislative Audit and Review Committee. That report pointed to concerns about DDA eligibility criteria and practices, resulting in a recommendation to take immediate steps to ensure that only eligible clients are on its caseload. The WACs in effect at that time had changed very little since 1989. And most of you are probably familiar somewhat with the details of that revision in 2005, which along with explicit criteria for each of the eligibility categories also included rules for required expirations and reviews. Those were not part of the previous rules. So the content of the 2005 rules met legislative expectations and is consistent with the definition of developmental disability in RCW. Because of that, the intent of our 2014 revision was not to make any significant changes to the scope of individuals we serve, the eligibility criteria, or the process. But after following these rules for more than 8 years, we had come to see that some parts of the rules needed revision. They were not working smoothly, and they were, I'll just paraphrase, they were not really keeping up with the changes in our medical community. They were not able to keep up with new research. So one of those changes, which I'll speak more on later, is the diagnostic criteria for autism, for example. The DSM-5 is now out. We were only following the DSM-4, so we now have more flexibility to follow both of those. So none of that is to say that DDA looked at the rule revision as an opportunity to make any real changes in eligibility criteria. The intent of this revision was simply to make our current rules clear and easier to understand and implement, both for intake and eligibility case managers and for the citizens of the state of Washington. So, some of the changes. We now do not have a requirement to review eligibility to review adults reviewed or made eligible since June 2005. We previously had to review adults when they were seeking paid services when they had not previously been seeking them, so that's a good change. We now allow children to be made eligible under a permanent condition at age 4 rather than age 6, so that simplifies things for our families. We allow children in the birth to 3 age group to be made eligible based on their early support for infants and toddlers requirements. So So if they're eligible under EST, they're eligible for us. We now allow ICAP for any eligibility category, including intellectual disability. If the applicant doesn't have a current adaptive test, we could not previously ICAP or perform that adaptive test for any of our applicants except under strict criteria. We have changed the by definition language in the other condition category. We now allow individuals with significant functional limitations to be made eligible if they have had a condition that caused intellectual and adaptive impairment. One of the most recent changes, we can now accept more diagnoses on the fetal alcohol spectrum. So that's a great benefit for the citizens of the state. We have three new IQ tests added to the list of acceptable tests. And the application of the criteria of too severe to be tested. So, of course, not all of our individuals that we serve can have adaptive or IQ tests or participate in those tests. So all the categories requiring those tests now have an exception to that process. And, of course, as I mentioned with autism, we still continue to allow eligibility under the DSM-4, but we also allow criteria to be accepted under the DSM-5. And the criteria for another neurological and other condition, which encompasses our neurological and chromosomal disabilities, for example, we can now accept evidence of academic delays as substantial limitations for children up to age 20. So again, that's a mouthful, a lot to say, but a lot has changed. But statistically, as we'll show later in our presentation, same numbers are eligible as before. We haven't so far seen any changes in the numbers of people found eligible or ineligible. So, Barbara.
My turn.
Yes.
Just so that everybody knows, I did make printouts of the PowerPoint, so if you'd like to take them with you to be able to look at later so that the eligibility categories will be apparent and you can refer to them at any time. Feel free to take one as before you leave tonight. So here's how an applicant becomes a client of BDA just by meeting certain criteria. Whether the individual has a developmental disability and substantial limitations. Becoming a DDA client doesn't guarantee a paid service, it just guarantees eligibility. Our eligibility is governed by the RCWs and the WACs listed. Our policies for intake and eligibility. We have a policy of how and who we can administer an ICAP to and determining what another condition is. And so this explains what a developmental disability is. It has to originate prior to the age of 18. It has to be expected to continue indefinitely and constitute a substantial limitation to the person's life. It has to be attributable to an intellectual disability, cerebral palsy, epilepsy, autism, or another neurological or other condition found by the secretary to be closely related to intellectual disability. The documentation that's needed when somebody applies is a diagnosis of an eligible condition that's not expected to improve or go away. Evidence that the condition was present prior to age 18, and evidence of substantial limitations, IQ scores, physical assistance needs, adaptive functioning tests, and the eligible conditions. We have five different conditions and eligibility categories, which are intellectual disability, cerebral palsy, epilepsy, autism, and another neurological or other condition similar to ID. What constitutes an intellectual disability is the diagnosis by an appropriate professional, which are listed in our WACs, a full-scale IQ, 69 or below, depending on what testing is used, and an adaptive functioning test more than two standard deviations below the norm. Cerebral palsy needs a diagnosis by a licensed physician of cerebral palsy, quadriplegia, hemiplegia, or dysplasia. The symptoms, we have to have documentation that it existed prior to age 3 and impaired motor control, motor movement, and needs direct physical assistance in 2 areas of living: toileting, bathing, eating, communication, mobility, any of the 2. Epilepsy, we have to have a diagnosis of a seizure disorder or epilepsy by a qualified professional, which is usually a neurologist. Seizures cannot be controlled. If they're controlled, it's not an eligible diagnosis. And then adaptive functioning test at more than 2 standard deviations below the mean. Autism, we need a diagnosis of autism, either under the DSM-4, which is 299, or the DSM-5 of autism spectrum disorder, with a severity level of 2 or 3. And the severity level is very important. We need a full-scale IQ score below 85, or evidence of meeting the DSM-4 TR diagnosis criteria. And we need evidence of onset prior to age 3, and adaptive functioning tests of more than 2 standard deviations below the mean. With another neurological or other condition, we need a diagnosis of a neurological or chromosomal disorder made by a licensed physician. The disorder results in an intellectual or adaptive skills deficits, full-scale IQ of 77 or below, depending on the test that's used, academic delays for children under 20, and an adaptive functioning test of more than 2 standard deviations below the mean. What is another condition? Clear definition and cause, clear diagnostic criteria must be a neurological or a chromosomal disorder. It needs to be known to cause intellectual impairment and must be known to cause adaptive skills deficit. And we have medical websites that list everything, and we can tell whether it's falls under that, because there are many different disorders. Impact of unrelated injury or illness. We have to be able to determine that the functional limitations are not a result of mental illness, behavior problems, injury or illness that happened after the age of 18, and injury or illness related to a qualifying diagnosis. And here's our age and eligibility. It tells you the age ranges of we have birth to 10. It can be developmental delay, medically intensive. We can accept ID. Cerebral palsy, epilepsy, autism, or another neurological from the age of 4 on. Expirations and review. Our eligibility actually expires. The first time it expires is at age 4, so the family must actually reapply for DDA eligibility prior to the child's 4th birthday, or their eligibility expires. They have to reapply before their 10th birthday, or their eligibility expires at 10. At 18, MICP, the Medically Intensive Children's Program, their eligibility automatically expires. And some eligibility may be temporarily extended if the person receives MPC services. And then the reviews are done at age 19 if the determination was before the age of 16. If it was after 16, they do not need to be reviewed, or if we think that there's fraudulent or miscommunication. Yes?
Question about that. Okay. It expires at 18, but
for medically intensive.
Only
the medically intensive children's program. It doesn't expire till 19 for anybody else under any other category.
Okay, thank you.
No problem. Yes?
I don't know if you want to answer questions now.
Sure, I can answer. I'd be happy to answer as we go along.
All right. Who and how are parents going to be reminded when their child is approaching their 10th birthday? Oh, by the way, eligibility is going to expire.
Yeah, we actually send out a letter to every family 6 months prior to that date. 3 months prior to that date, we send out a PAN, So they get two notices that eligibility is expiring and that they need to call and reapply. And all I have to do is call the office and say I want to reapply. They get a new application and we're good to go. So they're notified twice, and then if they have a case manager, if they're in paid services, that case manager, 30 days before it expires, actually calls the family and tells them.
So we had some mention about paperwork that may or may not be appropriately getting to you, and you said mm-hmm. something about the school's paperwork. And we have some educators in here, so... Mm-hmm.
What paperwork do we need?
Yeah.
We need the evaluation summary, and it has to be the most recent evaluation summary. It's actually very critical, particularly with these expirations, that we have new information, because sometimes the old information does not continue to make somebody eligible, particularly adaptive scores. A child at 2 is not the same as a child at 4 or a child at 10. So new adaptive testing, new whatever the summary assessment is, they can stay eligible under developmental delay only until age 10. Then we have to have an eligibility category, so we actually have to have the diagnosis, the full-scale IQ, the adaptive testing and deficit stuff. Question? Okay.
When does that fit in when the schools do their?
Well, the most recent, she said, every 3 years you have to do a reevaluation. So does the parent then is required to contact the school to get that information sent, or does the
no?
State
we usually fax or release the information as long as the family has given us one. We always fax it to the school, and then the schools. Most of the schools have been really good about faxing information back. Sometimes I think fax machines don't always work, but they usually call if they don't.
So it's just getting a release?
Yeah, we have to have a release from the family to work with the school district, and they have to have a release to be able to give it to us. Otherwise, it's a HIPAA violation. None of us want those. So the determination process, this is pretty much how it works. Somebody submits a request for DDA eligibility determination. They submit evidence, the required evidence. Now our caseworkers do assist in gathering evidence as long as they put everybody on the release, either numbers or addresses. And then our workers enter all the information into our care system, and the worker evaluates the evidence to make sure it follows. We tab everything and highlight just to make sure everything's dated and initialed. And then the care determines eligibility based on the evidence entered. So our computer system actually will determine eligibility. Then the NSA, which in a child's case is usually the parent. In an adult, they have the right to choose who their representative is, unless they have a guardian. And we verify for eligible applicants that they have an NSA. And then we send the planned action notice to the applicant and also to the NSA, whoever that may be. And, yes.
What does NSA stand for?
Necessary Supplemental Accommodation. It means it's the representative for the person to be able to explain the paperwork to them. That's why a child under 18, it's always the parent. Because the parent needs to know, with somebody over the age of 18, it's somebody who is willing to explain the documentation to them and the eligibility so that they understand it. Or they can help them make a decision on whether they want a service, want a fair hearing, so that they know what their rights are.
It's
accommodation.
It was a name created by lawyers to mean a person that, sorry, a person that helps somebody understand our documentation, because often what we as the state send people is hard to understand, and we want people to have the best chance of understanding documents.
And there's always a worker's name and phone number on the planned action notice. Birth to three, it's always mine. Everybody else, it depends on the worker, whoever made the decision. There's always their name and phone number, and there's always a fair hearing document attached.
So this should not be confused with the NSA of the federal government.
No, it should not.
National security. No,
that's not us. No, we're just trying to get
really
people
exciting,
to help
though.
Somebody understand it.
Maybe eligibility said a computer determines eligibility.
Well, we have workers that enter all the information, they go over it, they evaluate it, but yes, then they input it into our care system, and our care will tell us whether somebody has the ability to be eligible or not according to the criteria that's been inputted.
So does the human go over that afterwards?
Yes.
Oh, it's a human decision, there's no doubt. The computer will just help them know whether somebody's eligible or not, if they have enough evidence in there to make somebody eligible, or if there's not enough evidence in there to be eligible. And yes, there's always a person. So, and they're always listed, yes.
So from the time, on that previous slide where you had the determination process,
yes.
From the time an applicant submits a request to the time that they're told, yes, you're eligible for services or not, is there a timeline that is required?
Traditionally, we try and have everything done within 90 days. We make a decision within 30 days of receiving the last eligibility documentation. However, if there's some reason that we need to go over 90 days, such as the family calls us and says, we're having testing next week, can you hold off on making your decision? Our workers just SER it, and they can continue it past the next. It's a service episode record. They record it so that we know why it's over 90 days. We have a 90-day requirement to make a decision with what we have. But they can document the fact that there's a reason why they're going longer than 90 days, and that's always either a doctor, a school district, or the family has said, this information is coming to you, we're getting it to you, please wait, and then they can wait longer than the 90 days. And now you're on.
No. So this is basically showing you our numbers historically, so statewide. So far, since we changed our rules in July 2014, we processed, well, when I took this on May 4th, 7,944 applications, of which almost 82% were eligible. About 16% were ineligible, and about 2% were withdrawn, and we're pretty consistent with last year so far. I am, as a program manager, very interested in making sure that our new rules have not changed how we determine eligibility, because the intent was not to make changes. It was just to make them clearer, easier to understand, and help us keep up to date with current research.
I think Darlene had a question.
Oh, I have a couple of them. Sorry.
Yeah.
So one of the questions I have in looking at this, and I realize that eligibility happens at 4, 10, and 18, 19, right? So there's the re-eligibility. Do we have it broke down by first-time people applying? And because our numbers are not going up, the total number of clients served by DDA is not going up anywhere near that.
Well, so keep in mind, what one of the changes that we had happen last year, or actually a little bit longer than a year ago, is when folks that are eligible and are requesting services, they don't need to reapply. So one of the reasons we did that is because we did not get FTEs or more staff to accommodate our increased service levels, because what the legislature has given us is the ability to serve more people, but they didn't give us more staff to make eligibility determinations. And so one of the ways we accomplished this is by changing our need to review people. So all the people that were made eligible from 2005 forward met that age criteria, didn't need a new determination.
But what I'm saying is, so DDA has about 42,000 individuals that they serve statewide. So it hasn't even gone up 8,000 people since 2011, Okay, even if you rule out the re-eligibility at the different ages, we're not seeing an increase in the total number of individuals served. Now, obviously, we're going to have some individuals who leave the system due to death, moving, different things like that. But you would think if you're doing these kinds of numbers, we would be seeing the total numbers the DDA is serving going up substantially greater than what we're
Well, this includes expirations. So this includes, which is the large majority of the decisions that the workers have to make. So new applications through attrition and through the changes last year, our population is fairly steady or increasing. So this doesn't let you see the comparison of when our need to review changed or show it in statistically show it with increase or show attrition rates.
Can you lift out Clark County in data?
Yes.
I know you can't right now, today.
Yes.
At the moment. But, you know.
Yes, I can.
Okay.
And yes, by and region, because we talked about that yesterday.
Yes.
Because this is statewide, right?
This is statewide. But yes, I can, and I can try to get at what you're asking.
Okay. I'm just curious, because, yeah. I mean, you would think that even if, you know, a portion of those, just a small portion were new applications, that we would have seen a greater increase in the last 4 or 5 years from the total number of individuals served.
A lot of the people into new into service are not new applications.
Right.
A lot of them are already clients and will require you an eligibility commission because of the change in the rule. So that's what I just wanted to mention. Because that's some of our legislative funding was for those clients right that are with us but are not receiving service. And that's where we see a lot of additional people into service.
Right, but I'm talking total number of people eligible for DDA, not total number served.
Well, so. Attrition accounts for most of this. People leaving services or passing away. It's fairly steady. We see increased growth. Long term, we see our numbers going up, but we see dramatically more people in paid services because of legislative action. But total population served is only increases very slowly.
Who does the withdrawing?
That has to be the applicant. So can you explain why someone would withdraw?
Okay. There are several reasons for withdrawal. The main reasons for withdrawal is they're going to go past the 90 days and they have testing that they're going to have done either at the school district, at a doctor's office, at an autism clinic, and that appointment is 2 months down the road. We explain to them they can reapply at any time and they have the choice of withdrawing the application or having it extend past the 90 days. And some people choose to withdraw. The other reason would be, and they can apply, yes, they can apply again at any time. Even if they're denied, they can apply again. Sometimes it is very apparent from an application if we can determine that somebody is not eligible, we will explain to the family why we believe the person is not eligible. And they also have the choice. Do you want a planned action list sent to you with a denial? Do you want to withdraw the application and reapply if you get new information that fits this criteria? And our eligibility workers do explain exactly what it is that they need to get to be eligible in the different categories.
So if you're denied, you're in the record, but if you withdraw, you're not.
No, you're still in there. We have a record.
No, you're still in
there.
Oh, yeah. It's because they get a withdrawal pen.
Yeah, we still have to send them a right to appeal their decision to withdraw.
Yes, they always get a planned action notice, whether it's withdrawal, denial, or eligible. That a lot of times families will get confused because they get a planned action notice stating they're eligible. First, the three families in particular call me a lot and say, do I need to fill out this for a hearing? Well, no, not if you want to be eligible. But you have the right to say, I don't want to be eligible, as much as you have the right to say, I want to be eligible.
Yeah, we're legally required. Every decision we make, we have to give that, but it is.
We just inform everybody, no matter what it is we do, it's recorded.
One of the things that we're working on this next year is improving our planned action notice, making it at least a portion of it plain talk. We are obligated to have all the legal information in there, but we've been working with our legal advocates, and they've actually helped us craft some new language that can help families understand why they were denied, for example, if they were found ineligible. Just as one example, if the IQ tests we got were not two standard deviations below the mean, not everyone took statistics, so what we would say is your IQ score was too high, which makes sense to all of us, but you know, we have to get approval to do changes like that. Is this a legal document?
David, loud.
Yeah. When you're in the adult system, and you've been determined eligible, does DEA require you to continue to show your eligibility, or is that something for Social Security?
That's Social Security. After the age of 19, once they've had a 19-year review, if they've been made eligible from 2005 forward, we never review them again.
So I know the people that you're talking about, I know the one is 19, but are the others children?
A 12-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 15-year-old.
Okay.
I was wondering if you break out your data by age, and you should age groups at all.
I can.
Okay.
It would get a little...
Just come today,
yeah.
Just kind of see where the trends are.
Yeah, and I know Darla is really interested in making sure that we don't have a trend, because she has seen a pattern of people coming to her that and it's seen an increase of people being found ineligible, and we want to get to the bottom of that.
Mm-hmm.
Statistically, we don't see it, but as Mary was asking, well, we're going to look at Clark County specifically. I've known Mary a long time, so.
Well, it's. I think it's good for probably every county to be aware enough to see if something's going on in their community. So we, if it's right, we can explain it, and if it's not right, we can fix it.
And we're always transparent. And statistically, we can be transparent easily. One-on-one cases, we have to have a consent so from the family. But of course, Darla was a great advocate.
So, quick question. Sorry, I'm trying to remember it now because I got your attention.
You always have my attention, Darla.
I'm so sorry, but I don't have a brain to remember the question. I know what it was. And this is more of a historical question. I think I know the answer, but I'm wondering if maybe this is where we need to put time and effort. It used to be the case manager, that the person on a local level was more able to help the family, and they would determine that the person wasn't eligible, right? Or if they were eligible, right? Where now it's like, it seems like the family has to make sure you guys have all the paperwork to determine eligible, or you're determined ineligible. So it's a slight difference. Am I articulating that clearly at all?
Yeah. Years ago, you could go to someone's house, and you pretty much could figure that out if you were an eligibility worker.
Or the eligibility worker would help, you know, would track it down a little bit and make sure that the person was ineligible, as well as, you know, where now it looks like we're just trying to make sure they're eligible.
But I think the legislature did this.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. You know, we need to fix it.
Well, one of the problems was that they were finding inconsistencies between areas of our state. And that, I think that's what caused it to come up to the regional offices rather than in the local office.
Yeah, and the thing, I am interested in breakdown by county or by geographical area, because a person, and I think it's true, but I want to validate with the anecdotal things you brought forward, is that a person found eligible or ineligible in Clark County should be able to take the same exact packet of information and go to Grant County and have the exact same determination. Statistically, that's true. We have the supervisors, I'm drawing a blank. They do a review of every worker's one eligible and ineligible determination quarterly. And we do it statewide by an external group about annually. We're getting prepared to do another blind poll of those files.
We just have to sort it out. And we don't have an autism center close here, you know that. So the schools are heavily relied upon for documentation. And we probably need to let them, we probably need to give them an update on that. So we probably need to tell them how dependent it really is.
Well, and you still have your local partners that can do, that can talk one-on-one about eligibility or questions. They have access to the same exact paperwork and information in our databases that Barbara or a caseworker in Tacoma or someone else would have. So you still have your local contacts. You haven't lost that just because we want our workers to be with their supervisor and have quality control and training one-on-one. And by the way, the person that does administrative hearings is located here in Clark County, one of the people, and she's your former eligibility worker.
And my former caseworker, and she's one of them.
She is. Yeah.
Another question. DE eligibility isn't the same as waiver eligibility.
No, it's not. That's a good question. It's a good question. So becoming eligible, being found eligible for DEA, and I'm going to do a long answer to your question, if you don't mind, doesn't mean that the person needs or wants any services at all, necessarily. Of course, it typically does. So we have many, many different services and programs. We have several different waivers. We're about to start a new waiver here any day as soon as we get approval. New individual and family services waiver. There are different requirements for different services and different programs. For example, most of our folks, if they get any service, the first service they usually get is personal care. To receive personal care, you need to have a Medicaid coupon, so you need some financial eligibility. The caseworker also needs to go out and do an assessment and make sure you qualify and need personal care. For waiver, there's a similar assessment. That one assessment process that caseworkers evaluating many things, and it's to make sure that they meet what's called ICF ID level of care, or intermediate care facility for the intellectually disabled. It's a federal standard. And so people that receive waivers also have to meet that criteria. But really what it comes down to is need for the service and desire for the service. And so one of the best things that families can do, they don't need to know all of that. That's all these details that we've just told you about. What they need to know is that they need to be able to call a case manager and say, this is the need. Like, I'm tired. To us, that means they need respite. Or, my son or daughter or my adult brother or sibling, they need help getting dressed in the morning and I can't do it every day. To us, that means they need personal care. So if families just know that they can talk to us, whether the person's located in Tacoma or like our great case managers, like Darren and Angie, if they're located here, if they can say what's going on, then we can get them the right service.
Talk to us about the eligibility for the Medicaid coupon, the financial eligibility. Because it was always my understanding that it was as much an issue of function as it was an issue of finances.
For the coupon, it's not function, it's all financial.
It's all financial.
It's all financial.
So who would qualify?
Oh goodness, I can't quote the. I think it's.
Well, adults
200% of federal poverty level.
Yeah, and adults over the age of 18, their parents and
their parents not count
it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. The 18-year-old is on their own.
Okay.
Yeah.
But so. Why you might have that confusion is because when we get kiddos that come to us and their needs are such that they need a waiver. If we determine that they meet the functional eligibility for a waiver, we can then, that individual, that child, whose parent may also be higher than that percentage of the federal poverty level, they then qualify on their own income.
That's the distinction. Yeah, it's for waiver services.
Yeah, so even if if you hear of a family that they have a decent or average income, and they think, gosh, I will never get services. That's not true. The conversation still begins based on that person or that child's needs. Because if we have that information, then we can start talking about what we can do to meet that need.
I have one more question. I'm sorry. And this might actually be a question for Barbara and Sue. So you were talking about academic delays can be used to identify the substantial limitations. So if you have the adaptive testing done and it shows one thing, but you have the academic delays that show substantial limitation as well as the IQ score, which one of those are you going to?
We need both the IQ score and adaptive deficits greater than 2 standard deviations.
And academic delays, it's testing and broad reading and broad mathematics, 2 standard deviations below the mean. I think it's, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's not very often that we get to that, yeah. That's new.
Very rare.
But what I'm saying is if you had the IQ, you have the academic that qualified, and you had an adaptive score that they also did, the adaptive score they can qualify, would you take these two and not take that one?
No. We have to have an adaptive deficit as well as a full-scale IQ.
But what if you had, I don't know if I can actually off the cuff. If you had adaptive that was a little bit too high, but you had, we might have to get back to you on this. And you had broad reading, broad mathematics scores, 2 standard deviations below them that were enough. Could the person be eligible? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
I'd have to look at the whole picture is the problem. But that's what the workers look at. Traditionally, no. Traditionally, they look at full adaptive. We look at those, but I don't know if it replaces an adaptive according to the lab.
My concern is that the adaptive is based on parent input.
Correct.
And parents, you know, I can sit here and I can tell you for 10 years all the great things my sons can do and how incredible they are and how highly skilled they are. And that's typically how parents respond to things. And that raises the adaptive skills. And you would never know that this young man who is so highly skilled and so social and does all of these great things also is so incredibly low in other areas if I didn't know to tell you that. You know what I mean? So that it
usually though
that
psychologists and school psychologists that are doing adaptive testing would explain what it is and what they're answering and why they're answering it and how to evaluate some of that. Our psychologists have.
I've never had a school psychologist.
Really? Okay. They just do an adaptive test?
They just send it home in the backpack and say, fill this out. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So.
What?
Yeah.
They don't see the psychologist?
You gotta go back to this page, don't
you? Okay. Page is that?
Training and information
program. Oh, there
you go.
Okay.
I still cite those over that stuff.
We don't usually get
it shows their typical here, their extreme here. And then what those different categories mean.
See, I think there may be a disconnect with the processes between school and...
Well, I can just say that between schools, even in the same district, we have three.
Yeah.
Sure. That's all the district to district, because I cover three counties, it can be anything. So it helps if you have a standard process, and then these parents know exactly what tests they're supposed to be getting, or what information they should be expecting from the schools.
Yes.
Just, Darla's not crazy.
I'm not kidding.
No.
In different areas.
Interesting. Well, we had it sorted. Oh, we still have sorting.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll still.
I have to four.
Four.
Yes.
Yeah.
If they're under the another neurological or other condition.
Right.
So look at black 388-823-0610.
What?
Say that again.
I'm going to leave this with you.
Thank you.
I'm working on it.
For everybody else, so 888.
388-823-0610.
06.
Thank you.
You're welcome. But you can have my copy.
Oh.
Thanks.
388-823-0610. I don't think it's on that, is it? Or
well,
did I give it to you?
No, but you sent me this when this first came up.
Yeah, I think we just talked about ID.
Yeah.
So.
I can see.
So we kind of, I have more slides on services. Just really quickly, we already kind of talked about this, so I'm, services, so you have to meet criteria for the specific service. Some of the services do require funding, like our state program for individual and family services. It's limited because it's state money, but like I said, we're going to a waiver any day now. As soon as we get approval from CMS, we'll have a new waiver. These are just some of the examples of our services. It's not all of them. I just kind of picked out categories. Most people just get a few services. Not everybody needs all of this, right? Residential services. We have a broad selection because, well, you only need one residential service, right? And everybody's different. People need different levels of support. So for our children, kind of the highest need kids where their parents want to keep being parents, but you know, they need another place for their children to live, that would be voluntary placement services. So that's out-of-home services for kids. Our adult services are those above the voluntary placement, and they range in all different support levels. Adult family homes, that's really living in somebody's house, supported living. That's in your own home with typically lots of support. Ranges from a few hours a day to 24 hours a day. So just briefly, residential services. But the thing I want you to leave with, if you can go and talk to any families today, that would be why apply. And it's not about services, it's about access to them, and it's about access to the other things that we offer. Because access to DDA means you also get access to the DD Life Opportunities Trust. So your family members can protect their money. It's a good opportunity for them. Access to information and other great benefits, like reduced bus fares, fishing licenses, other things. A lot of families don't think they need services, so they don't want to apply. And maybe they don't need them now, but try and sell them on that anyway. Okay. That's what I have. More questions? Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. So we'll give the board an update. Either you will come back and give them a Clark County update, or you can send it to me.
I'll probably at the statistics.
Yeah.
Okay.
Whatever you'd like. Or you can make your own day.
My computer.
My name's Ingrid Warden, and I'm with PAVE, and I'm a parent research coordinator for their parent training information program. So it's called PTI, and every state has a PTI program. And in Washington State, it's called PAVE, or under the auspices of PAVE. And PAVE is located up in Tacoma, and most of their programs, I gave you the kind of the summary here, are located up in the Seattle-Tacoma area. So in Clark County, I'm the only representative in this area. So I'm covering Clark, Calix, and Skamania by myself, which is quite interesting. I get to see a lot of schools, and I see how things are done very differently, which gives me a lot of insight into how parents get confused and how I can step into the process and try to help them. So basically what I do is I offer training and information to parents who have kids in special education or they're seeking an evaluation for special education. Maybe they get reports home or say today I had two calls for kids who were kicked out of school, you know, and expelled. What do we do now? So it's usually kind of a crisis situation when people call me, and it's, you know, it takes a lot of time for parents to explain the process. A lot of time their kids have been in a number of different schools. They have a lot of, you know, complex diagnosis, and try to sort out how can I help them as an advocate. My main goal is to try to empower parents to learn how to advocate for themselves, learn more about their rights and responsibilities, to understand IEPs and 504s, and it's really pretty overwhelming for parents because the jargon just goes at a very fast pace at these meetings, and usually the administrators and the educators, they all understand what they're talking about, and the parents going like, you know, what's happened. So my job is to try to make sure the parent has information, kind of be that bridge between administrators and parents. And my role in the year and a half I've been here is to try to build those lines of communication between administrators who are kind of afraid of parents, and then parents at the bottom, giving them information, support, trainings, and really trying to educate parents on the process and how to be better communicators and how to be more effective managers when they go to a meeting and really try to solve problems. And the goal of an IEP meeting is really for the team, a team of people all interested in the best interests of the child, you know, forming an education plan. And it's really about 80% communication, and that's really been my focus, is trying to build those bridges, because I can't be at every meeting, obviously. I go to a lot of meetings, but it's not effective for me to try to solve problems for parents. So my goal is to try to connect with agencies and organizations, find out, you know, what's going on here in Clark County. I work with Darla quite a bit. She has a lot of great resources for families, and try to empower parents to be, you know, you're the parent. This is your child. You're the expert. Here's resources. I can help you if you have a particular problem, or say your child's getting expelled, or you have a hearing. You know, I can kind of step in and really provide those resources. But I would have to say that, so just to backtrack, I have two children. They're in their 20s. They both, one, my son was on an IEP, severely dyslexic, a lot of perceptual problems, communication problems. I knew every principal. I baked a lot of cookies. You know, he eventually graduated from high school, went to college, and he's gainfully employed. And, you know, in fifth grade, they told me, your son's either going to be a nightclub singer or a janitor. And I'm thinking, whoa, you know, he doesn't like to clean and he doesn't have any musical skills. So we need to have a new life plan. So. And then my daughter, she's very bright, super academic, but she has some very severe health problems. So she was on a 504 plan, and that really was a struggle to get the school to give her just minimal of support so she could, I mean, she was their top student and a valedictorian, but, you know, she missed a third of the days at school because of her illness. But so I had two kind of very different kids, and both with very good outcomes. And that was in Colorado. So I came here to this area, and so I don't really know the schools. I don't have personal experiences. I don't have any connections. So for me, I'm just kind of an outsider trying to fit together. How do people talk to each other, and where do parents go, and trying to streamline the process, because
Most parents in crisis, they're calling like 50 people on the phone. They have no idea who you are or who they've called or what you can do for them. So I really try to encourage parents to sink into a network and to try to, you know, keep track of the data and their information and to find resources. And the other part of that is I try to work with school districts and, you know, community organizations and DDA and DVR and, you know, all these acronym soup that's out there to try to provide those connections for parents. And that's been really, really helpful. And I think there's a huge disconnect between schools and community partners, you know, so they're not really aware of what's going on in the community. So I think there's an opportunity to, you know, speak to like special services in Vancouver or Evergreen and say with DDA or DVR and try to coordinate some of our services. And, you know, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. I think everything's out there. We just need to kind of bring things together and really help parents to see that they can make a difference. So, and I work with kids from birth to 21, and I've recently gotten involved with Head Start, ECOF, and that could be like a full-time position for someone like me, because they have, you know, a lot of different sites, they have a huge level of need, and again, kind of that disconnection from what they're doing to the school district, and everyone's doing a great, you know, deal of work, but we're not kind of capitalizing on all that information and all that good work that's been done, so it's kind of, I guess they call it siloing, I've heard. You know, so it's just really hard to kind of get people to talk to each other and to find ways to connect. So that's just been my emphasis. Maybe I'm lazy, I don't know, or an opportunist, but I can't do it all. I'm just one person down here and trying to see how we can all help each other out and help families and just kind of reduce the stress on families, because I can tell you that the people who call and cry on the phone, I mean, legitimately, I mean, they have really pretty overwhelming situation. I mean, I've gotten people who threatened suicide and they've called the crisis line, and I'm still working with that family a year and a half later. But I mean, they have a lot of legitimate problems with the school. It's not that the parents are not paying attention or not involved. They have kiddos who are really, really complex with a lot of the issues we're talking about today, and the schools, they're just kind of overwhelmed right now. So I would appreciate anyone's help. I mean, I'm basically not shy to say that I am just overwhelmed with phone calls and meetings and trainings and just trying to meet the need. So
yeah, if I didn't have a Belgian wife, I don't know how we would navigate this whole American system.
Sometimes it helps if you're not from here, right? You know, see things differently. Mm-hmm. So does anyone have any questions? Or
where is your funding? Are you all privately funded? Or
Department of Education funds a parent training program in every state. Mm-hmm. So
in Oregon, isn't the Swindells, or no, there's OPTI Oregon?
It's actually FACT. FACT of Oregon, FACT, Families and Children Together, since 2012.
It's changed.
Yeah, and if you want to look at their website, they have a phenomenal website in Oregon, a lot of great resources, and they do a lot with Disability Rights Oregon. They have a lot of great publications.
That's FACT?
FACT, Oregon.org. I mean, it's kind of my competition, but I think they have a really terrific kind of online webinars and like really good information on parents, how to, you know, advocate for your kids, how to prepare a person-centered plan, which I know you've talked about, and, you know, how when you go to a meeting to put down, you know, the two or three things you want to talk about in like a business format and try to really accomplish something at IEP meetings. And frankly, I go to a lot of meetings, and say today I was just over at the Vancouver District Office about an IEP for this young man I'm working with. And I've been working with his family since I started, so nearly a year and a half. And it's just been one problem after the next. Not the parents' issue, not the kids' issue. It's on the school side, and we finally got to an administrator at the Vancouver schools. I hope no one's here from. I love her. So, I mean, for me, I made that connection with the administrator at the middle school, and we can go there. She trusts me that I'm not going to ambush her. She knows that I'm bringing the parents in. and we came up with a really good plan to address issues that we've not been able to solve at the school. So sometimes you just have to make those connections with people at a certain level who have the expertise and the interest in solving problems. So that's a long-winded answer, but fact of Oregon, they have great resources.
I wouldn't consider them your competition as much as just different territory.
Different territory, and I'd like to see our program adopt some of their, they've really had kind of a whole strategic plan where they've tried to target parents and really educate parents and put the power with the parent.
Who's in charge of PAVE then at the state level? How does the organization work?
Well, in Tacoma, Tracy Callow is the executive director of PAVE, and then I give you a list of all the different programs.
Is there a board of directors, or is there?
Oh yeah, and so they have an executive board, and they do fundraising, and they're very. I rarely see them twice a year, so I'm kind of here on the frontier. But PTI program, my supervisor is Vicki McKinney. I don't know if any of you.
But there's only one of these per state.
One per state.
One per state.
Well, not one person, though. One.
No, not one person. Yeah. One organization.
Right, and we have six individuals in our program statewide.
Statewide, you have six people.
Yeah. Oof.
Are you actually located in Clark County? Or?
I am. I'm in Vancouver, yeah. And so then I cover kind of the bottom of the state here.
I know years ago, there have been various people before you in your position. I've met various people over the years. They did have a real, realizing that it was so much for one person to do that they were getting inundated.
Right.
They tried to have a focus on educating parents or even educating some, citizens in the community who would, either as parents or not, accompany other people to their IEPs and help them as advocates. But it seemed like not as many parents will proactively educate themselves as come out when there's a crisis, when they're, unfortunately in need.
Well, I think a lot of people trust that the school's going to take care of it and everything's going to be done, and I think if they maybe have good teachers or good principal and they don't have a problem, but then maybe their kid's in middle school and they get suspended and then they get in trouble and kind of the problems kind of escalate. And I think most parents don't realize how complex it is. So when you have a crisis, then it's almost impossible to concentrate on learning all that information. So one thing I do like about FACT, and I'll go back to them, is they have a training system, a series for new families. So they try to get parents kind of transitioning into kindergarten and have them really learn the basics and then to go to meetings, and they have workbooks and just really try to get parents to take ownership of the IEP, because frankly, nobody explains it to parents. I mean, you go to a meeting and people, they just start talking. There's no real introduction for parents or no real kind of primer on here's the things you need to know, here's some resources for you, here's a list of trainings. Frankly, I think people just, they don't understand the process, and people around them and teachers and educators, they all, not because they're thoughtless, but they just deal with it every day. Parents, they're just like walking into a foreign country and saying, I don't understand anything that's been said, but it must be okay, and I'll sign the paper, and, and I'm not having a problem, so, I'm not going to worry about it. So I think parents have just not had an opportunity to, and maybe they don't care. I went to a meeting the other day where the guy said, 90% of my parents don't come to meetings, so I just called the mom in this case and told her over the phone that we were going to redo her IEP, and I just slapped down some new information and sent it out to her, and now this kid is being expelled, and we've gone a year and a half with no IEP meeting, and his justification is, well, nobody ever comes. So, and I said, well, these parents always come. You just didn't notify them. So,
Darla, do you want to shut them up? Or is it, or do we
no,
have
it's
to?
It's next time.
It's through the wall.
Oh, it's through the wall?
Yeah.
So I'm in here in Clark County. I answer phone calls from people, email. I have tons of great resources. I will go to meetings if I have time in my schedule. I think I'm the only organization left right that goes to meetings. And so I think it's really important to go to those meetings and see what's going on. But again, it takes a lot of my time, and I'm not reaching a whole lot of parents that way. So, and I think that it's the kind of, most of my meetings are pretty difficult, even for me. I've been through the wars with my own kids, and I think for most parents, they are not really emotionally prepared for the kind of stuff that goes on in these meetings, unfortunately. So, I don't have any answers other than say, work on education, work on supporting our parents, providing trainings. Darla offers trainings at the ARC on from emotions to advocacy, and a lot of follow-up and groups. And I have parents groups now in the center, and in, or I shouldn't say I do, but through the ARC or through Parent Coalition, trying to get parents organized in Ridgefield and the center and Vancouver, and how can they come together and support each other, and just put it really back to people who have a vested interest in making it better.
Well, thank you very much.
One last question.
I can speak very highly of Washington Pave. I have a son that was in the school district, one of the school districts locally, which will remain unnamed.
Okay.
And we had disagreements with the school district on what was the least restrictive environment and inclusion and appropriate setting for him, and we wanted him to be included as much as possible, and they had their idea on what was right for him. And Washington Pave was one organization that we found very helpful. Now, they didn't have a representative in this area, I don't believe, at the time, but we were able to contact people in the office and get some very helpful information from them, mm-hmm. and support and ideas and direction on how we should go. And it was extremely helpful to us.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that.
There has been a lot. And he's a working man today, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Awesome. Like my son, he's not a janitor. So. Yeah. Nothing wrong with being a janitor.
Yeah.
He
now works
in
the hospital.
No.
No, he's a rock climbing instructor at Zion National Park, so he walks to work.
So he's a rock star.
Spends his
rock star.
Time.
He's a rock star.
he spends his days outside, and always, I think they have a million people that go through there every year, so it's a lot of new people, and he's doing very well with that. So.
Good.
Okay, well, thank you for your time. I appreciate the invitation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So guess what? We still have a legislative session going on. So here's the last we've seen on the budget.
Are you guys walking out on Wednesday too?
Yeah, I'm walking out on Wednesday.
I just got the voicemail from Cam, so I'm not sure what time.
Is Cam walking out?
We will need to.
Yeah, she hasn't listened to the voicemail.
Yeah, it's my voicemail. Looks like it's from the main line.
What we've heard is that there's not a lot of movement between the House and the Senate on budgets. There's a couple proposals. One of them has to do with property tax dollars. The other one has to do with capital gains. Trying to figure out how do we take additional take some of the dollars and just move them around and divide them up differently so that we can fund the schools. The other one is trying to gain new dollars. So, stay tuned for that. I don't really know what else to say about that. Both the House and the Senate, and I should double check before I say this because my brain's old, but I have the waiver slots for the transition students in there.
Well, I think it's really important, that we explain, that we get the budget language to DDA as quickly as possible.
We got to get a budget.
Well, we have to get a budget, when we get a budget.
We will. And but it's the school stuff that's holding it up. This is our bills that we got through. So as you can see, although we have no budget yet, as advocates, we were very successful this year. And almost all of the faces are smiley. There's a couple scratching your head ones. So guardianship complaints and courthouse facilitators are a couple with scratching their heads, and it's just because it didn't go far enough to actually do what we needed it to do. The bill was a little soft on what we wanted it to do. The ones that have in the status have the little money looking things, they're necessary to implement the budget and going to be put into the budget hopefully as it goes forward. The governor has signed many of the stuff that's already has already gone to him. The ABLE Act, the Restraint and Seclusion Bill, several of those. This is not, what's been signed by the governor has not been updated since the 23rd, so.
Isn't that a zombie?
It is a zombie, yes. The walk is necessary to implement the budget, there you go. So, policy-wise, it was a pretty good year. Budget-wise, yes, stay tuned. you know, the concern with capital gains is that when people hear capital gains, they think that it's going to go over into income tax, and that rolling forward, it will be an income tax for the state of Washington. I'm not sure that that's true or not, but I think that's the fear that we're hearing. And that even though you start with people who make, you know, over $250,000, I think it's higher than that, or $500,000 for a couple, that it will eventually erode down and be everyone. So those are the fears. These are our bills. We did good so far. We're not done yet. Oh, are you talking about the, did you send out for the hearing tomorrow, the work session?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so there was a news article that came out about a young lady that once, there was just significant abuse that had occurred, had been investigated, and nothing done farther than that. And then the mother passed away, and another family member took over. The family member that was thought to be one of the perpetrators of the abuse early on, and the abuse just was significantly worse going forward. That's actually happened, I want to say 2011?
Yeah, I think so. It's pretty huge.
So, I mean, it's been a while. It's not new, but it's new in the news. There's lawsuits going on, and there is a joint committee work session tomorrow in Olympia with the health care committee, the Senate health care committee, and mental health committee. Is that right? That's wrong. That's not what they call that second committee, but the committee that's over mental health.
You joint, so House Senate?
Yeah.
Is health care? That's the one. Human services?
Huh? Health and human services, and then another one.
Okay.
Yeah.
The last thing.
Anyway, so there's.
What's the last thing?
Been
on the news?
I'll forward it to you.
It's Seattle Times.
Seattle Times. I will forward it to you.
You don't want to read it.
You don't. I didn't send it out to the families because it's.
Disturbing.
Very disturbing.
Was this
and
a family member?
Was here in Vancouver?
No,
it was in Seattle. So there is a hearing, a work session on that tomorrow. We do have a board that's going to testify from the community, most of them from Seattle area, that's going to be testifying on that. I suspect the fallout from that is not going to be real great. In a multitude of ways. I mean, I think DDA is going to be under a lot of scrutiny, but I also think community settings and family members as providers are going to be under a lot of scrutiny as well. And so we're going to have to really watch that and watch how it goes forward. We need to, I don't care who or where, who the provider is or where the individual lives, there needs to be oversight and there needs to be substantial oversight in all settings. because just because somebody's a blood relative doesn't mean that they have the skill set or the ability to provide the care that needs to be. And consequently, I think that there's a lot of stuff that happens in other settings that maybe doesn't reach the news as well.
Well, we know that the stuff that happens in RHCs doesn't reach the news. Yeah. It never gets out unless
CMS. It's not that it's not happening, it just doesn't get out.
But is there a report on this, you're saying? So does it address all the timeliness of investigations once they actually happen?
Right now, it's an article that just talks about the issues, right? And so I think, is it DRW that's involved?
I'm sure that.
And there's a private attorney's involved, and now the joint committee tomorrow. So yes, there will be a lot, and timeliness of stuff is going to be part of what's addressed, as well as how people follow up on situations. But I...
Yeah. It just it seems like it would go without saying, but when you have, for example, APS has 90 days to do an investigation, and the individual is just free to do whatever they wish for that entire 90 days until there's a determination, because APS doesn't put, we as a county put limitations on that, but APS does not, so.
And that's adult. For those who
adult protective services.
Is that who did the investigation here? That there was no who was the investigating body?
Dropped the ball.
The police did an investigation on it. I think DDA did an investigation, and I don't know who the other entity was, but it seemed like there was three different.
But the DDA may have turned it over to APS,
right?
Because that's what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, right.
So, but everybody, I'm afraid for DDA in it because. I don't know what the case manager was instructed to do, but somebody should have done something.
In the article, it states that the case managers through DDA don't do enough oversight, but DDA's caseload is 175-1, and they compared it to CPS. Well, CPS's caseload is like 1-19, I think, or something like that, individuals. So, of course, CPS can be in there on a weekly basis or a monthly basis, checking on things, where DDA goes once a year. I'm going to take off all my hats and just be a mom for a second. I'm sorry, guys. But the other thing is, like, so my son went recently, and he's in a companion home, and we did the companion home provider had their yearly
exit
interview. Thank you. We had a yearly exit interview. And the organization, which is a state-level organization that comes in and looks at the residential settings, right? Now, I've met this man three different times, and he doesn't remember ever meeting me, which is fine. I'm not necessarily rememberable. But he was shocked and amazed that there was a family member involved. And I almost felt, except this is me, so I didn't, but... like I needed to apologize for being there and participating in my son's life and overseeing the residential setting and everything that goes on. And I do that no more for my children with disabilities as I do my children without disabilities. I consider that being a mom. And so I just think there's some,
but that
there's
is
some concern.
This was a personal care situation, though.
Yeah, this was personal care. It wasn't residential.
Right, so it's... I don't know what kind of scrutiny SEIU, I mean, does to its, the union. What scrutiny do they have of the providers that...
They just have the background check.
They do a background check and you have to do the training.
The training, and then does anybody ever check? So when you get into trouble, DDA is supposed to call APS. That's
right.
Their procedure. And then if APS doesn't investigate appropriately, it's going to fall down still on DDA. And we here had problems with APS. Now, I think the person now is probably better than in the past, though. Wouldn't you say?
For what? For
the APS? APS.
Maybe.
Because we used to have people that would not follow up even on rapes.
Yeah.
I mean, they're following up, but I'm sure, I don't know what their caseload is like, and it just seems to take
Well, even with CPS, they're not, even with the smaller caseloads, the family situations and situations where I see CPS involved, they're not protecting the child to the level that I would think they should need to, even when they are involved. Huh. So, I mean, there's just, it's a lot of concern.
So. But my also concern is where it's being exposed when it should be broader.
Yes,
it's absolutely. It shouldn't be targeted at one.
Right.
Okay. Well, I have a kind of warped mind because of my job. Exposure to a little too much.
Yeah,
and
me too.
It's just with the abuse happening for people with developmental disability, any vulnerable adult, the elderly, abuse happens in to children with no disability, and it's just a human occurrence, tragic and unfortunate, but it is. So what do you do? I would certainly hope that this wouldn't come down, you know, with some sort of result that put parents and family members to a higher scrutiny than other people are, just because this occurs all across the community for many populations.
As a parent whose child, I have a child in a companion home and I have a child who lives independently with Medicaid personal care, I personally think there needs to be some more scrutiny in every situation.
Well, there at least needs to be a real investigation with evidence. That's the worst case scenario is somebody said something and nothing happened. Yeah. You know.
When I say more scrutiny on parents, I mean not more scrutiny on every parent of a child with disability or every family member caring for a child with disability. But definitely procedures need to be tight when some allegation is made to do a thorough, prompt, quick investigation and get to the bottom of it. But I'm just saying, I don't want certain situations to cause this sort of
fear. And it needs to be across the board because family members by far, you know, what is it, 64% of all individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities that are customers of DDA live at home with their family members, right? And so it needs to be across the board. Because, you know, someday we're not going to be here. And if I didn't have the sense to make sure that my kids were okay, I would want to make sure that somebody, some other organization was overseeing them.
Okay. Well, that's the legislature.
Yeah.
And the hearing tomorrow, more news to come. I don't know what they're doing about the budget, but they're talking about other things. So,
hello. I
have
been hearing had asked my manager, Jim Corey, if I would come in tonight. I was thinking I was going to be talking right at 5:15, and then sitting here, I feel like I was sneaking into a movie, so thank you for letting me join you. My name is Emily Harris, and I work for WISE. I think you have had the opportunity to do some work with Jim Corey, who's my manager, on the employment event. I just wanted to come tonight and just introduce myself to the board. There's some familiar faces in the room. Just give you a little bit of background about myself. I have been working for WISE for the past month and a half, and it feels like 10 years. I've done so much in so little amount of time, so I'm really pleased to be here. Prior to working at WISE, I worked for an organization called OTEC, which is in Oregon. Are people familiar with OTEC?
Oregon Tech.
Yeah, Oregon Technical Assistance Corporation, and so it's kind of like the Washington counterpart to technical assistance and training with a more broad focus. So I was doing trainings related to employment for people with disabilities, doing work with families and organizations, and also doing some in-home behavior consultation. Prior to that, I worked in Clark County, so this is my alma mater. After college, I worked for Trillium Employment Services, helping people to get jobs in the community. So I'm really happy to be back. Over the last month, right when I started my job at WISE, I also started working here in Clark County teaching the Highline class. So I'm the spring quarter doing the natural supports on the job long term. So it's been a whirlwind, but I'm really pleased to be back here. And we just opened up a new office that's in Portland. We're going to be having an open house on June 4th. You're all welcome to stop by. It's in the Pearl. And it's really nice to have an office in Portland because one of the things that we're doing is we're coordinating a series of trainings across the state for employment consultants called the Oregon Employment Learning Network. So one of my jobs is going to be coordinating that, training in that, and then also doing some work in Washington and Clark County. Any questions? Or?
I think Emily's going to be working with Jim on next year's event. Good to get a face now.
We're very happy to have you here. You can sneak into our movie anytime.
Every painful moments and laughter is great.
We're here every other month. Same time, first Wednesday. You're always welcome. And if you have anything you want to talk about, you can call Mary to get on the agenda. And you can always just show up and
talk.
Okay.
Tell us. We have the community input, you know.
Yeah. Tell us what you have new.
And I brought cards if anyone's interested in calling me later and or emailing me and be in touch.
So I think, are you also helping with the transition or training series a little bit now too? So.
Yes, and so I mentioned it's a month and a half in, so I'm still kind of realizing what does it all mean now? But yes, I'm going to be doing some work with Jamie Leighton on the family training series. And we'll probably be doing Highline next year and then the employer event and also facilitating person-centered plans in Clark County and doing ITA work. So, and one of my passions just on the side is doing kind of innovative, low-tech, high-tech supports to help people get into jobs. So I'm hoping to utilize those skills here in this neck of the woods too. Yes.
Yeah, please.
Some familiar names. I recall seeing you. You know how to get a hold of me.
I know. It's always nice to have a card. Thank you.
And I was looking at you.
Did you come out to any of those WISE conferences in last year? No.
You know, well, I used to work as an employment consultant here in Vancouver, so I was at the event. Yes, but not last year, but multiple years before that. And Mary, you also, I know you.
So this is the open house.
He can share it with you though. Well, I noticed that Herb Lovett is one of the contributors, and I have a book of Herb's that I've never read. Trish, are you ready?
Yeah. Online, you can do the art.
One of his books. She's a friend of mine.
The night is growing long, so I'll keep it quick. So I wanted to give the board and everybody an update on the request for qualifications process. So every 4 years, the county is required to release a request for qualifications for our adult day program services and our children's services, all of our day program services that we provide.
And we have done a request for qualifications, or RFQ, just recently. And we have successfully qualified a new agency in town. So that agency is Washington Vocational Services, and they will be on contract with us effective July 1. And we're meeting with them, we're in the process of meeting with them to get them oriented to the county and working on the contracting process with them.
Great.
So we're excited to welcome them to our community.
We should have them come and say something at some point.
Yeah, we'll invite them to the board. To
maybe July.
It's just to replace that one woman who wouldn't give.
Oh. Well, we're required to do RFQs every 4 years, and our capacity has been a little stretched because you also have to maintain a certain level of placements and employment in order to take new customers. So we've needed to expand, I think. So does it replace her? Maybe. I don't know. Hopefully we're raising the bar again. The last couple times we've raised the bar.
Any other questions about the RFQ process? We have some advisory board members who reviewed the application packets and were very helpful in that. So thank you. That was Leanne and Meredy and Trista. Yeah, as well.
Do we have any new business?
Only that the summit, if the board is interested in, or people from the community are interested in going to the summit, then get in touch with me.
Okay.
Or Stephen.
Are you going to send out some information?
And Wise has sent. Emily, could you send? Would you send, I thought I forwarded something, but
yeah,
I will.
I
will go ahead and do it.
Summit.
Yeah. Okay, I will send out something tomorrow to all of you about the summit. And then if you do register and you're on the board or you're someone from the community, then put stipend.
Just like that.
Mark the things that
can. Can I do that with anything I want to go through?
No. I can do approve the stipend. You're not going to the Portland Company, okay?
Mary sent this out yesterday, registered for the Dictionary Summit.
Oh, okay.
It means we're adjourned, but it was a link to.